tonight I'm going to do a little bit of a PR job on the Buddhist suttas. I'm going to talk about the discourses that the Buddha taught about 2,500 years ago. And these are the interesting thing about this, and the wonderful kind of historical reality is that those discourses that we have today that we call the Buddhist suttas, they are essentially just that, the Buddhist suttas. They are the word of the Buddha. And I might talk a little bit later on about exactly how we can know that and how we can be so sure of that. But it's an amazing kind of historical thing when you think about it. 2,500 years later, we still have pretty much what the Buddha talked about at that time. I want to talk about why these are important and why, as a Buddhist or people who are even just interested in Buddhism, why we need to study these things and what they can actually do for us and what kind of is their place in the Buddhist practice. These are the things I want to discuss. And hopefully, my idea is to hopefully to encourage some of you to actually start looking at those suttas, start reading them and get some inspiration from the word of the Buddha himself. Because as far as I'm concerned, this is actually a very important part of the Buddhist path. And one of the things that I have always noticed when I have been traveling, I travel occasionally, not that much, not compared to Ajahn Brahm, I travel hardly at all, but I still occasionally go in different places, overseas even. And from all the, I've been a monk now for about 16 years, so it's quite a while, and I've seen quite a lot of the Buddhist world. And one thing you actually realize when you travel around is that the sort of things, the sort of talks that people listen to, the sort of teachings that people read, is almost always this teacher, that monk, this nun, this lay teacher. It's perhaps the Mahasayadaw tradition or the Goenka tradition, or is the Paok Sayadaw tradition, or is the Visuddhimagga tradition or the Abhidhamma tradition, or it's the Ajahn Brahm tradition, or it's the whatever other traditions are there. All these traditions out there, everybody's practicing this kind of systems of thought, following a particular teacher. But how often do you hear anybody say simply, I practice the Buddhist or the Buddha's tradition, and that's all there's to it? Nobody says that. Everybody has some kind of other tradition that they're practicing. And this you see again and again as you travel around the world. Everybody is following a certain teacher, somebody else. And when they read something, they read the books of that teacher. When they listen to talks, they listen to the talks of that particular teacher. Sometimes it's a Tibetan tradition, sometimes the Mahayana tradition, sometimes some kind of sub-tradition within Theravada. But very, very rarely is it actually the word of the Buddha himself. And this is, in my opinion, it's unfortunate, because these traditions may have a lot of good things in them. I'm not saying that these traditions are bad or evil or anything like that. Certainly not. But the point is that you can never really know with absolute certainty how accurately they reflect the word of the Buddha unless you read it for yourself and you find out what's actually going on in those suttas. Now, I think there is a very good reason why people tend to why people tend to go to all these different traditions rather than going to the word of the Buddha. And the reason for that is a historical one. The historical reason is that the suttas have only existed in the Pali language or even in Sanskrit languages up until very, very recently. For the last maybe 2,000 years before they were translated into modern languages, they only existed basically in Pali and Sanskrit. And nobody could actually read them except for a very small group of specialist monks and also perhaps nuns, but that's a long time ago now, that were actually able to read these suttas. And these were only accessible to this tiny little group of elitist monks and nuns around monasteries in Asia. And apart from that, nobody had direct access to these suttas. And if you were a layperson, or if you were a monastic who didn't understand Pali, you had to rely on these other experts to actually be able to understand the word of the Buddha. You had this filter, if you like. You had filtered through other people. And because of that, what happened over time was that we got these traditions that certain teachers were the ones that would transmit the word of the Buddha to you. And that's why people started to go to teachers to use these teachers in various traditions as their guidance for how to practice the Buddhist path. And they weren't able, they didn't have access to the suttas, to the word of the Buddha himself. And this is a problem. And this is actually quite an important and significant problem if you think about it. For those of you who have read some of the suttas, you would probably know that the Buddha himself said that the Dhamma should be taught in the local language of people. So that when the Dhamma comes to the West, when it comes to Australia, it should be taught in English. When it goes to Thailand, it should be taught in Thai. When it goes to China, in Chinese. When it goes to Norway, which happens to be my home country, it should be taught in Norwegian. When it goes to anywhere else, it should be taught in that language which is there, so that people can understand what the Buddha actually taught. And this is kind of one of the foundational things in the Buddhist practice, is that this is how this Dhamma should be taught. And yet, we have gone so far away from that foundational thing that today, or not today anymore, but up until very recently, people had no direct access to these suttas at all. And I understand even today, if you go to places like Sri Lanka, for example, and you try to read the suttas in Sinhalese, which is the language spoken in Sri Lanka, it's actually quite difficult, because the language is like a very lofty and elevated Sinhalese language. And it's a language which is very formal and very full of Pali words and Pali phrases, and it's hard to understand. If you go to Thailand, it's the same problem. In Thailand as well, the language used to actually translate the suttas into Thai is again a very formal one, and it's very difficult for ordinary people to understand and grasp that language. And even in English, if you look at some of the first translations that were done into English about 100 years ago, they had this kind of Victorian feeling to them. There was all this "the," actually even pre-Victorian, I think, all the "thes" and the "thous" and that sort of stuff. And when you read it, you felt like you were sort of transported into an alternative reality. It wasn't really English. It was some kind of, Shakespearean thing sometime. And that is unfortunate because, that's not how the Buddha taught. He taught in the contemporary language of the day in India. And fortunately now we are beginning to see very good and very reliable translations, very easy to read translations in modern English, and which are very pleasant and very easy to read. And that is a great thing. And that is exactly how the Buddha said it should be. And for that reason, we should take the opportunity, now that these suttas are available, we should take the opportunity for ourselves to try to access those suttas and see what it was that he taught, get a very clear understanding of what these things were all about. Because it can be very dangerous to rely on a teacher. I have seen myself during my lifetime as a monk, you see teachers doing all kinds of crazy things. They may seem often very inspiring in the beginning, often they can be very charismatic and they can have a lot of metta perhaps, and people are like, magnet, it's almost like a magnet to people. People get drawn into these people. And then it turns out that even though they have this kind of external charismatic appearance, when it comes to the internal qualities, they are not as solid as people think they are. And then they start doing crazy things like, they start having, if they're monastic, they start having relationships with other people. Or if it isn't that bad, at least they start sliding into all kind of luxury and all kind of things which are unseemly for a monastic. And of course, what happens when this happens is that the people who think they have faith in something which is Buddhism, they get very, very disappointed. And sometimes they lose their faith, they lose their willingness to practice, and they throw out the whole baby with the bathwater because they think Buddhism is some kind of corrupt religion, which is no good for anybody. And of course, that is very, very unfortunate. But that is what happens when you rely, when you rely on like a teacher to teach you rather than the Buddha himself. And sometimes it isn't that bad. Sometimes it's not as if the teacher goes completely berserk and does really wild things. Sometimes it's simply that the teacher is teaching it, which isn't quite in accordance with the way the Buddha taught. Sometimes the teacher things which is slightly different, slightly maybe not leading exactly in the same way. It doesn't actually take you on exactly the same path that the Buddha taught. it doesn't take you to the same states of deep peace and bliss that the Buddha said are available for people. They do not actually go to the same goal that the Buddha talked about. And because of that, again, this is a much more subtle difficulty. And it's very, very difficult sometimes to know whether the teacher you have is teaching the right path. And the only way you can know that is by going back to the word of the Buddha and using that as your foundation stone. That should be where you find your ultimate kind of reference point as to whether anybody is teaching the right path. And this is very important. And of course, that also goes for Ajahn Brahm's teachings. I mean, you know, of course, what I say as well, of course, anybody's teachings. It's not as if, you know, one person, just because he happens to be the teacher here, is somehow elevated above that criteria. He's not. It goes for everybody. Everybody should be checked out in this particular way. And the problem that you are seeing here, the reason why it is so dangerous to rely on individual teachers, this is a problem of refuge. It's a problem of going for refuge in the wrong place. And in Buddhism, there is nowhere does the Buddha say that we should go for refuge to individual people, that we should take an individual person as our teacher and place all our confidence in that person. And when that person does something stupid, we lose all that faith and confidence. In fact, that is against the idea of Buddhist refuge. A Buddhist refuge is always a refuge in the triple gem, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. That is the real refuge. Now, what does that mean? Now, first of all, the idea of refuge just simply means that there is a place that we can go, a place where we can ask questions, a place where we can seek solutions to problems in life when they arise. We're all going to have problems from time to time. And it's wonderful to have a source of like wisdom and inspiring teachings, of understanding, which can help us when problems arise. Not only that, but of course they can also help us to actually improve our lives, even if we already have a pretty good life. It can always be better. It's not as if anybody, you know, doesn't want to be more at peace, more contented, more happy in their life. We all want that. Everybody wants less problems and difficulties. That's just the way it is. And if we find some kind of teaching which can help us with that, of course, that is that we should, you know, again, that is what we should be doing. So the point here is that the refuge here is the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. And the Buddha is the historical Buddha that lived 2,500 years ago. Now, you cannot go to the Buddha now and say, I've got these problems, I've got this I want to do. He's not around anymore. So, what should we do instead? We go to his teachings. And this is the Dhamma, which are his teachings. So that is where we go for refuge. So the Buddha Dhamma comes around this one thing, which are the suttas that are available today. This is where the refuge is now. Both the Buddha refuge and the Dhamma refuge are found in those suttas. And that is important, as two of the refuges straight away point straight back to the suttas. The third refuge is the Sangha. Now, the Sangha is the monastic, usually known as the monastic community, but of course, it doesn't just mean that there is a refuge in any kind of individual monk or individual nun. It's a community as a whole that you take refuge in. Because that community is the carrier of Buddhism traditionally. So this is a community which normally specializes in Buddhism. So just as if you feel ill, you go to the doctor, you don't go to the plumber. The plumber might give you some dangerous things if you go there. In the same way, if you have a spiritual problem, you go to the Sangha rather than go to somewhere else. That is the traditional way of doing it. Because the Sangha specializes in these teachings and practices them, hopefully, to the best of their ability. And within that Sangha, and the reason why that Sangha is so powerful, is because within that Sangha, you're supposed to find the Arya Sangha, the noble ones, the ones who have practiced the teachings to the point where they understand the teaching of the Buddha. So in a sense, that is where you find your refuge, in that Arya Sangha. And that Arya Sangha, that because they have realized the teachings of the Buddha, because they understand them, their teachings are exactly the same as the teachings of the Buddha. They may use their own words, they may use their own phrases, they may explain it in a different way from what you're used to, but it points back to the same source, the same Dhamma. That is what they are teaching. So, again, it is pointing back to the Dhamma that the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago, the suttas, the things that we have available today here. So again, even the Sangha is pointing back to those same suttas, to that thing which we know today is the word of the Buddha. So there you are. That is the triple gem for you. That whole triple gem points in one direction, to the suttas, to these beautiful teachings that we have available from the Buddha. And there's another way of looking at this as well, and that is to, you know, if you think about it, if you think about, well, you know, we all want to have a teacher who is enlightened, who understands this teaching, who has a lot of compassion and kindness, who is wise and peaceful and all these kind of things. And everybody's always competing about, you know, who is most enlightened and who is not enlightened. And when you travel around the world and you meet monks and lay people from here and there, everybody says, oh, my teacher is enlightened, my teacher is an arahant, you know. I don't know about all these other teachers, but my teacher is definitely an arahant. And you find this happening again and again. And after a while you think, gee, there must be lots of arahants in the world if all these people are arahants. And you start to realize that you can't trust this, you know. Just because people say that their teacher is an arahant, it doesn't actually mean all that much, because we all want our teacher to be somebody special. We have to justify why we are a disciple of this teacher, right? Why are you a disciple of somebody who hasn't got his act together? Of course you have. You know, that's why you think your teacher is an arahant. So this is not really a very good criterion. We realize that we cannot just go about all this hearsay and all these things that other people say here. That doesn't actually work. And in the end of the day, even when we have a teacher here, that we have been around for a long time and we have watched them and we have seen that the conduct is pure and beautiful and kind and all these kind of things, still, at the end of the day, you can never be absolutely sure whether they really teach the true teaching. And this is the problem in life. The only person that we have to assume is awakened, has understood the Buddha's teachings, is the Buddha himself. If the Buddha is not awakened, if the Buddha doesn't know what he's talking about, basically this whole thing we call Buddhism just collapses into absolutely nothing. It doesn't exist anymore. All these other teachers, all these teachings that we have, they rely on one thing. They rely on the assumption that the Buddha actually was awakened 2,500 years ago. Take him away, everything else is null and void and just collapses. And that is for that reason, because the Buddha is really, at the end of the day, is the only person we have to assume was awakened. That is where we should place our confidence. That is where we should read the teachings, because that is what has to be right. And then everything else has to be compared to that. Everything else has to match up to those teachings. And only then should they really be accepted as genuine, if they do not contradict what was said by the Buddha himself. So these are some of the ways that I urge you to think about the Dhamma. Don't go searching too much for teachers. It is actually, I should say, it is very important to have teachers. It is very useful to have somebody you feel has, you know, understood things. It is these two things in Buddhism which I personally always found very powerful. And one thing is that we have an ancient tradition which goes back 2,500 years, which has been proven again and again. And that for me is very powerful, that you can read the suttas, which are so ancient, and yet feel a sense of familiarity when you open them. That is very, very powerful. That is one kind of leg on which this edifice of Buddhism sort of stands on for me, the sutta. The second one is that you find people today who practice these teachings and actually attains, or at least seem to attain, some of the results that the Buddha talked about 2,500 years ago. There is the ancientness, and there is also the contemporariness of this teaching coming together. That is a very, very powerful blend. Imagine that you find somebody, some kind of guru, who, you know, goes around saying, I'm awakened, but has absolutely no tradition that he follows. He only praises himself and he doesn't have anything to look up to, anything other than himself or herself for that matter. But that is always a bit dodgy. You always feel a little bit, oh, okay, wait, I'm not sure about this. It sounds maybe a little bit selfish or a little bit self-centered or whatever. But when you have that combination of an ancient tradition, of even the most highly attained spiritual master in Buddhism will bow down to the Buddha. Now that is a very powerful thing, and it has a kind of egolessness to it, which is very, very useful. So that is why this is important again, why this sutta matters so much. And I would like you to show you maybe now in practice how this can actually work out. And I'd like you to remind you of one of the stories in Ajahn Brahm's book. I'm sure most of you have read Ajahn Brahm's book, The Opening Door of Your Heart. But there's a story in that book about when Ajahn Brahm went to Central America, to the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, and that is where the ancient Mayan civilization existed. About, I think, I'm not sure now, I get my dates wrong here, maybe 1,000 or 1,500 years ago, something like that. And of course, this Mayan civilization, they built pyramids. They weren't as large as the ones in Egypt, but nevertheless, they built pyramids. Ajahn Brahm tells a story when he went to this Yucatan Peninsula, and he was traveling through the jungle, and the jungle there is very dense and very thick. You can only see a few meters ahead of you. And he gets to this pyramid, and he walks up the pyramid, and for the first time in days, he can actually see the landscape all around. He could see the roads going through the jungle, he could see the little rivers, he could see maybe the other pyramids coming up through the jungle cover. And he realized suddenly that this was an amazing metaphor for what happens in meditation practice. Meditation practice is just like this. When you have a deep meditation for the first time, it's like you elevate yourself above the jungle of life with all the problems, all the things that are happening in life, and suddenly you can see all around and you can understand life, understand this thing we call sensuality, understand how we operate as human beings for the first time. And I always thought that was a very interesting simile. I thought, well, this is quite powerful. And then one day I was reading the suttas and I came across this. And I will read this to you to give you a feeling for what the suttas are like. It's very nice to talk about the suttas as an abstract, but here I'm going to give you the real deal, as I say here. So this is a simile straight from the suttas, and it goes as follows. Suppose there were a high mountain not far from a village or town, and two friends would approach that mountain hand in hand. One of them would climb to the top, and the other stand at the foot. The one at the foot of the mountain tells his friend on the top, "Friend, what do you see from the top of the mountain?" The other replies, "I see pleasant parks, pleasant forests, pleasant lands, and pleasant ponds." The one at the foot of the mountain says, "It is not possible that you can see pleasant parks, pleasant forests, pleasant lands, and pleasant ponds." Then the one on top of the mountain comes down and, taking the one at the foot of the mountain by the arm, leads him to the top. After giving him a few moments to catch his breath, he asks, "Well, friend, what do you see from the top of the mountain?" He says, "I see pleasant parks, pleasant forests, pleasant lands, and pleasant ponds." The other says, "Friend, it was about this that you said, 'It is not possible to see pleasant parks, pleasant forests, pleasant lands, and pleasant ponds from the top of the mountain.' And now you say, 'I see pleasant parks, pleasant forests, pleasant lands, and pleasant ponds.'" And the other replies, "Friend, I was obstructed by this huge mountain and did not see what was there to be seen." So that is the simile. This is from the suttas. And to give you the framework around this, now this is after a discussion about meditation. There is a monk who says to a prince that it is possible in the Buddha's teachings to gain samadhi, deep states of meditation, one-pointedness of mind. This is possible in the Buddhist meditation. And the prince says, "Rubbish, no such thing is possible." And then the Buddha says to this monk that, well, of course he couldn't understand because he was obstructed by this big mountain. This big mountain is is a word here for ignorance or for the five hindrances, the things that obstruct you from seeing things. And only when you get to the top of that mountain, when you get the overview, can you actually understand what is going on. And for me, I must say, it was very powerful when I read this sutta. And I thought to myself, gee, I don't actually know to this day whether Ajahn Brahm originally read this sutta and then maybe subconsciously applied it to his own teaching, or whether it just happens to be almost virtually identical to what is found in the suttas. But it's powerful. And for me, I already liked Ajahn Brahm similarly. But the point is that when you read it, and it comes from the word of the Buddha, it gives it much more authority, much more power, and you realize the importance of this. And it also makes you respect Ajahn Brahm as a teacher when you see that the way he teaches is so close to the word of the Buddha. And in fact, this is one of the things, one of the reasons why the suttas are so useful, because they give us a guidance as to who actually has understood these teachings and who hasn't. And that is actually very useful. It doesn't mean that we should become very judgmental as people, that we should go around denouncing this teacher and praising that teacher. Of course not. But what it means is that it gives us a rough idea of where we should place our confidence. And that matters. We have to be honest about it. It does matter. Some people are worthy of confidence, other people less so. That's just the way things happen to be. Some people are good meditators, some people are not. Some people are wise, some people are not so wise. You know, it doesn't mean that we should become, you know, upset and negative about the people who aren't so wise. It just means that we are dealing with a reality here. This is just the way things are. And it's important to have some sense for where we should place that confidence. And that is what the suttas do. And this kind of thing, for me, this is a very simple way of seeing how this works. It's very simple because it's so identical, the two similes. Very often it isn't that easy. Nevertheless, as you get acquainted by the suttas, you start to be able to make your own judgment about things. And that is a very, very, very powerful thing. There's one thing I should have mentioned before, which I didn't say. And this is one of the things that the Buddha said. I don't know when he said this, but he talked about the future perils for Buddhism. And he says one of those future perils is that in future, people will listen to all these poets and poetry. They will listen to what they call the outsiders. Outsiders are people outside of the Buddhist religion. He said they will listen to savakas. Savakas are the disciples of the Buddha or the disciple of the Buddhist teachings. And they will be interested. They will lend an ear. And they will try to understand when these things are happening, these things are being spoken. But when the word of the Buddha, profound teachings connected with emptiness, as it says in the sutta, are being spoken, they will not be interested. They will not lend an ear. And this, I feel, sort of sums up what has happened in large parts of the Buddhist world. That people are not so interested often in lending an ear when the profound suttas of the Buddha are being taught. And yet, they will often listen to these people who are really just disciples of the Buddha. So this is important, and it's amazing that this text is actually found in the Buddha's teachings. It shows how prescient he was, understanding how things are going to actually, what sort of course Buddhism will take in the future. Fortunately today, I think that there is actually a movement many places around the world to read the suttas again. That's a great thing. You find that some of the bestsellers, for example, in some of the spiritual publishers around the world, like Wisdom Publications in the US is one of the big spiritual publishers, some of the bestsellers they have these days are actually the suttas, and they sell them in the thousands of thousands, probably tens of thousands of copies of these things. That is great, and that is a kind of development I personally think should be encouraged, and it's great to move in that direction. But I want to bring up one more issue, which I think is very important for people, to give you a sense of confidence that what we are talking about when I say, use the word suttas, and I use the word the Buddha's discourses, actually are the words of the Buddha. Because you may think, you get this book and people tell you, well, these are the words of the Buddha, and you may think, well, how do I know that these things are the word of the Buddha? How can I tell this? And this is, in fact, I think it's very important. And it's very important because there is a lot of research out there today among researchers, linguists, and people who call themselves Buddhologists, which is a rather funny term in my opinion. It's an interesting term. But anyway, and these people, they do research in these particular areas. And there's a lot of research out there. And I'm going to summarize for you what this research says. And it's very important to actually take this kind of research seriously. Because if the word of the Buddha is as important as I'm trying to say it actually is for us, it is so incredibly fundamental, then it is important that we are absolutely honest about where that word of the Buddha is to be found. We cannot really afford to delude ourselves and pretend that something is the word of the Buddha when in fact it isn't. So how do we know that something is the word of the Buddha? Now, one of the most powerful ways that we know that, and that is that simply that these teachings have been preserved in different traditions over a very, very long period of time. So you find the word of the Buddha, for example, it has been translated into Chinese, for example. It also, some of the word of the Buddha is also in Tibetan. Some of the word of the Buddha is found in Sanskrit sources. Some of them, a lot of it, of course, in Pali. Some of it is found in languages you probably never heard of before because they are dead languages, we don't exist anymore. Languages such as Sogdian, which is like a Turkish language, or Khotanese, which is another Turkish language, which existed in Central Asia about 2,000 years ago. And these languages preserve these teachings. And what is amazing to know is that these lineages, these different sects of Buddhism that give rise to these different translations, different languages, they're separated from each other about 2,200 years ago, maybe 2,100 years ago. So that means that the teachings that we find today in Chinese, for example, and the ones that we found in the Pali, they have been separated for about 2,200 years. And then the amazing thing is, you take that Chinese, you read it, if you read Chinese, that is, you take the Pali, you read the Pali, again, if you read Pali, and you compare them, and you see, wow, it is virtually almost identical, the same. After 2,200 years, it's not exactly the same. There are small changes there, which you would expect because of corruptions over time, but they are virtually the same. And that is an incredibly powerful thing, if you think about it. That these texts are so similar after 2,200 years, and it gives you a very powerful ground to actually know that what we have today is indeed the teachings of the Buddha. You're almost back to the time of the Buddha, where these things were separated, and they are still almost exactly the same. So that is the first thing that it shows you. The other thing that it shows you is that those things which exist in common between the Chinese, between the Pali, between the Sanskrit, it is that commonality in teachings which are also the most original teachings. Because all the different schools have these teachings, it means that they came from a source which lay before those schools separated from each other. So again, it is very easy then to actually decide what is the word of the Buddha and what we have to be much more careful with, and which may not be the word of the Buddha. And to make a long story short, what it all comes down to is that those teachings that you find in the Pali Canon are some of the very best, some of the very most original teachings that are available today. Sometimes you can also use the teaching in the Chinese Canon, and you can use that to sort of help you correct maybe some of the mistakes that might have crept into the Pali. But generally speaking, the Pali Canon, the four main Nikayas of the Pali, are the place, the long discourses, the middle discourses, the connected discourses, and the numerical discourses of the Buddha. That is where you find the word of the Buddha. So I would encourage you to take those discourses up. We have a lot of them in the library over here. Take them up and start reading them. And I think you will find that they are sometimes inspiring. Sometimes you will have no idea what's going on, because sometimes they can be quite hard to understand these teachings. And that is why it is useful, after all, to have a teacher as well, somebody who can guide you in these kind of things. So I'm not saying that the teachers are useless, that you should just read on your own. On the contrary, teachers can be very useful to guide you. But as you start reading these things, as you start learning them, you start gaining a sense of independence, a sense of being your own man or your own woman, and being able to actually read these things in your own way and seeing what's actually going on there and making your own judgment about these things. And that is a very powerful feeling, to gain that sense of independence in Buddhism, where you feel that you are a Buddhist and you are sort of running your own life, so to speak. Of course, again, having a teacher is powerful and important and very useful, but you also have this independent source that you can use. It's very, very beautiful. And don't think that these teachings are very difficult to read and hard to read. Sometimes I know people think that all the suttas, they're so kind of elevated. How on earth can I, you know, ordinary me, expect to understand these things? They're not that elevated, not that hard to understand. They are meant for ordinary people. It was ordinary people that ordained at the time of the Buddha that became monks and nuns. It was these ordinary people that attained stages of enlightenment, that attained samadhi under the Buddha. So we are no different from those people. We are just the same. If they can understand them, we can understand them. If we can understand them, so could they. So they're not that hard. Yes, it is true, they look a little bit different when you start reading the suttas. You think, boy, this is quite repetitive, for example. And the reason for that is because it comes from an oral tradition. So they actually read quite differently from how you read literature today. But once you get used to that, once you get past that kind of barrier, you find that they actually speak quite directly to you. And that is great. And they are simple, practical teachings, very often extraordinarily practical. And sometimes you can apply them directly to your life. And sometimes they're also very evocative. They're very beautiful. They have like the simile of the mountain that I just talked to you just now. There is an enormous number of similes to be found in the suttas everywhere. It's very evocative and very powerful when you read that. And you feel inspired and you feel emotionally uplifted. You feel a sense of joy when you read these things sometimes. And that is also very powerful. So reading the suttas is not just about gaining intellectual understanding. It's also about gaining kind of spiritual nourishment, a sense of being lifted up, a sense of being inspired, a sense of wanting to meditate and wanting to practice the path. And all of these things are found in the suttas. And it's very powerful. And then you come here and you listen to a talk by Ajahn Brahm on Friday night. You understand the talk in an entirely new way when you have read the suttas beforehand. Sometimes people say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, he just tells stories and jokes. But there's a lot of serious Dhamma as well with Ajahn Brahm. It's like a mixture. And sometimes to grasp the serious Dhamma behind all the kind of happy facade, it's very helpful sometimes to read the suttas to understand what is actually happening there. And then everything becomes more powerful. Everything builds itself up. And then when you have a problem, you go to one of the monks. If you can, you go to Ajahn Brahm or to anybody else, and you ask them, what does this mean? I don't understand this. And after a while, when I sit here and I give a sutta reading on a Sunday, you know your suttas so well that you can sort of pick me up on places where I make mistakes, for example. That is where you know that you have a very good understanding of those suttas. Now, to give you an idea of what I think is a very kind of evocative sutta, which is very powerful, I will read one more sutta for you. This is also about mountains. I personally like mountains a lot, and I think many people do, because there's something majestic about mountains. They are big, heavy, powerful, and they give you this beautiful view of the world. So there's something very attractive about mountains, in my opinion. So this is this other sutta I want to read out. And this here starts off, the Blessed One said to King Pasenadi of Kosala. This is one of the ancient kings at the time of the Buddha. What do you think, great king? Here a man would come to you from the east, one who is trustworthy and reliable, and he would tell you, for sure, great king, you should know this. I am coming from the east, and there I saw a great mountain, high as the clouds, coming this way, crushing all living beings. Do whatever you think should be done, great king. Then a second man would come to you from the west. Then a third man would come to you from the north. Then a fourth man would come to you from the south, one who is trustworthy and reliable. And he would tell you, "For sure, great king, you should know this. I am coming from the south, and there I saw a great mountain, high as the clouds, coming this way, crushing all living beings. Do whatever you think should be done, great king." If, great king, such a great peril should arise, such a terrible destruction of human life, the human state being so difficult to obtain, what should be done? And then the king replies, "If, venerable sir, such a great peril should arise, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious actions?" "I inform you," says the Buddha, "I inform you, great king, I announce to you, great king, aging and death are rolling in on you. When aging and death are rolling in on you, great king, what should be done?" The king replies, "As aging and death are rolling in on me, venerable sir, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds?" "So it is, great king, so it is, great king, as aging and death are rolling in on you, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds?" "Just as mountains of solid stone, massive, reaching to the sky, might draw together from all sides, crushing all in the four quarters, so aging and death come, rolling in over living beings. They spare none along the way, but come crushing everything." So that is one of my... I like the sutta a lot because I find it very evocative and very powerful. And it gives a very... For me, when I read this, it sort of gives me almost a bit of goose pimples. It's so powerful. And it makes it so clear that we're all heading in that direction of aging and death. And similarly there, for me at least, is powerful. Of course, for you, it may be different. So you need to take those suttas for yourself, read them, find something that works for you, and then find if you also can find that inspiration in those suttas. So that is my talk this evening. So does anybody have any questions or anything you want to ask about or comment on or any corrections to what I said perhaps or whatever? Please don't feel shy to ask stupid questions. It is perfectly allowable in this place to ask stupid questions. Usually they're very good questions. So whatever you want to do, anybody want to say anything? Everybody's perfectly happy? Amazing. Yes, please.
Let's say if you are attached to a teacher.
Yeah. I think what you're saying is that you find that you have a teacher that you are sort of attracted to, maybe attached to a little bit, and they seem to be a very good person, but later on they turn out not to be as good as they actually are. What should our reaction be? What should we do in that circumstance? And I think that maybe the first thing is that you try to point out to the teacher, you are going the wrong way. What is happening here? Why are you going the wrong way? This is not in accordance with the Buddha's teaching here. And maybe you find out that there has been a misunderstanding. Maybe there has been something which hasn't, maybe they don't really see what's happening there. And if they are a good and gracious teacher, they will take your admonishment and your correction very seriously. And they will point out to you why this happened. And they will maybe change their ways and become a different person in the future. So that is, in a sense, one way of seeing what sort of teacher you are dealing with here. Because if they are that humble, then of course something which may have looked wrong may actually turn out to be a good thing after all. So that is the first thing. But the second thing is simply that if you find that out, then it is the wonderful thing that you can, if it goes the wrong way, then very often you realize that you made a mistake, and you don't take the teachings of that teacher so seriously again in the future. Of course, it may be that even a teacher who does the wrong thing, it may be that they actually have certain aspects, certain ways of maybe teaching meditation, which is powerful, certain ways of doing things, which are very useful for you. And you can still keep practicing those things according to that teaching if you want to. You don't have to throw it all out if it works for you, so to speak. But it means that you become a little bit more skeptical about their teachings. It means that you maybe double-check again according to the suttas to make sure that everything is right the way it should be. And you're obviously not going to have the same faith and confidence in the future as you had in the past. And that is fine. Does that answer your... Is that what you were thinking of, roughly? Or you're happy with that? Okay, good. Anybody else have anything they want to bring up? Yes, sir. Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that numerical discourse is quite nice to start because it's actually an anthology. It's not the full numerical discourse. It's just selected suttas, so they have taken out the best ones, which often is a good help. But usually, I mean, one of the best places, there's two places you can start reading the suttas. And one is the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings. And the reason is because they are often like more than just a teaching. Often there are also a little bit of stories in there. There's all kind of things. And it makes it alive. It makes it, you get a feeling of what life was like in those days, in a sense, also when you read that. And then the teachings are often embedded in these kind of narrative things. And there's also a very wide variety of teachings in the Majjhima Nikaya. You get everything there from the most basic teachings to the highest kind of teachings available. So you can just flick through it. The nice thing about these suttas, you don't have to read from cover to cover. You can flick through and read whatever inspires you at the time. And the Majjhima Nikaya is also very well annotated. So when you read that, it has introductions which explain to the teachings before you even start reading the suttas. It has summaries of all the suttas. So you can actually look at the summaries and see, well, what do you think I should read today? And you can read that one. So all of these things makes it a very, very nice collection to read. So that's what I would recommend. Another thing you can read, and this is one of the probably the most favorite of all the Buddhist books, is to read Buddhist poetry. And the Dhammapada is the most famous book of Buddhist poetry. And everybody reads this one. And there exists, I think, about, I don't know what the count is, 60, 70, 80 different translations into English of the Dhammapada. Because it's so, people really like this one. And there's a lot of beautiful, beautiful stuff in there. Very, very beautiful verse. It can be very, very inspiring. Things like, very simple thing that the mind is the forerunner of all things, just like the hoof of the car, the cart follows the hoof of the ox, so all phenomena follows the mind, or something like that. I'm paraphrasing, I can't remember exactly how it works. And there's lots of beautiful little verses like that, full of that, which is inspiring and nice. So try a bit of both. Sometimes poetry can be nice, sometimes the straight suttas can be nice. So see whatever works for you. And you can also come to Rolamara here. We have sutta classes here as well. And if you have a chance to come to those, they can also be very useful. And you can ask questions about these things. I think a lot of these suttas are actually often I think they are kind of advertised beforehand, so you actually know which sutta is being spoken that particular Sunday. So you can look up if it's a sutta you like or not, and then if it isn't one you like, you can come and listen to it. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, sir. You can. I mean, there is a lot of sutta study available around, you know, around the world. People like Bhikkhu Bodhi, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, he does sutta studies. They happen here in Nolamara. Ajahn Brahm, occasionally I come here in here and do sutta studies. And you can listen to those sutta studies, and they can be very inspirational. I think the reason why it is more inspirational to hear them rather than to read them is simply because if it comes from somebody, you know, with a certain authority, somebody who is very peaceful, somebody who is very, you know, kind of happy and profound, you get this, it's like you listen in a different way when it comes from somebody like that. And that is why I think it was so powerful at the time of the Buddha to actually listen to the Buddha giving these discourses. But it depends on who the person is who reads these discourses. Some people may find that very powerful, others may not be so powerful. It really depends. So because of that, I think reading can sometimes also be very, very useful. Sometimes we have to do both. We both have to read and listen and sort of combine them all together. Sometimes you may be sitting at home, you may feel very nice, you may have had a nice meditation practice, and you open a sutta and you read it and you think, wow, that is so wonderful and so beautiful. And it gives a sense of happiness and joy to you. You just have to try, basically, and see how things evolve. Okay. Okay. Anything else, anybody? Okay.